It's good to be back here after a 25-year hiatus for the coming of age of science fiction in Australia. I have a great deal of pleasure in declaring open this World Science Fiction Convention.
That was Race Matthews, officially opening the AussieCon World Science Fiction Convention in Melbourne in 1975. Hi, this is David Grieg welcoming you to our podcast called Two Chairs Talking. Right at the moment, though, you only have one chair talking, as my regular co-host Perry Middlemiss is overseas right now attending this year's World Science Fiction Convention being held in Dublin. So, to redress the imbalance, I'm bringing you another Worldcon chair, Robin Johnson, in the form of an interview we did with him recently. Robin was the chairman of AussieCon, the very first World Science Fiction Convention ever to be held in Australia. That was in 1975, 44 years ago this month. AussieCon was a seminal event for the Australian science fiction community, creating a burst of interest in the genre and spurring the writing careers of a number of Australian authors. So over the next few episodes of this podcast, we'll bring you a number of interviews we've been doing with people associated with AussieCon, telling us about how they were involved and about their experiences of the convention itself. Promoting and winning the bid for the convention was a major exercise, as you'll hear. Here's Perry Middlemiss and Robin Johnson.
Robin Johnson, welcome to our little podcast. How are you today?
I'm good. Yesterday was a less brilliant day, but today's pretty good.
So you were in the New Zealand National Convention last week.
Yeah.
And you're in Melbourne now for the Australian National Convention Continuum over this coming weekend.
Actually, I'm not sure it is the Australian National one. I have an idea that was Perth this year.
Oh, okay.
It's just a Melbourne convention. And Continuum's been going for years now, and sometimes it's the national convention, sometimes it's not.
Yep.
And I'm pretty sure it was in Perth this year, okay. The national convention.
But this brings us to your continuing career of a very long career of going to science fiction conventions. But the major reason why we wanted to talk to you today was about a very special science fiction convention held in Melbourne in August 1975.
The first, also in winter.
The first Worldcon held in the Southern Hemisphere, AussieCon. Now, everybody calls it AussieCon 1, but I'm a stickler for the fact that it's AussieCon. AussieCon 2 was the second, and that's okay, but AussieCon is not AussieCon 1, it's just AussieCon. So how did you yourself come to the point where you got involved in, firstly, the bidding and then the running of this convention?
Well, let's see. When I arrived in Australia permanently, which was 1968, I think, about the only people I knew were fans. I'd been over a few times before. I used to work for what was then BOAC and is now part of British Airways. And one of the perks on that was you got cheap travel. And I came out about three or four times before I moved over permanently. And I was actually born in Australia. My father was born in London, but of Australian parents.
Okay.
And he'd got a job as ADC to the governor of Tasmania.
Okay.
And the result was that I was born in Tasmania in 1937. And so I'm Australian by birth. I'm not really much of a Tasmanian. I've lived in Tasmania for some years. But one of the nice things about turning up from England in 1968 was that I didn't need to go through any of the performances you needed to go through to become Australian. I was already Australian. Mm. And so I've been living in Australia since 68, having previously visited a few times through working for the airline. The people I'd met, I met Merv Binns, for example, in 63 or 4, I think.
Was he working at McGill's at that time?
He was working at McGill's. And I would have picked up my first copy of ASFR, John Bankson's ASFR then, I think, and a few other fanzines. I, since my family was basically based in New South Wales.
So you ended up moving to...
So I moved to Australia in 68, having been over a few times before, and basically stopped going back to England.
Okay.
And as of 1968, I was living in Sydney. I knew a few fans. There was a group that I'm trying to think who was involved with it. I'm going to have trouble with names now, but there were several people who were still around.
Kevin Dillon would have been around.
I think I met Kevin Dillon about then. I remember going to a meeting. This would have been before I moved there in 68, because one of the people that was there was a chap named Bluey Glick.
Not a name I remember, so, but anyway.
Yep.
And Bluey Glick couldn't really afford to go to the convention, which is in Melbourne. And we got up a fundraiser for him, and I think he was able to go. My first convention was the following year, 69, I think. And I seem to remember it was, I'm having trouble with the name of the suburb now, but it was not at Merv Binsey's place of work as the previous year had been.
Was this the Murrumbina? Murrumbina Cinema.
That's right.
Oh, okay.
There was a lovely cartoon done by John Bankson showing flies flying around him. Mm. And it referred to the number of women that were there. He wasn't used to that, I think.
Well, Shane McCormack turned up, and the Trekkies. That was the first year the Trekkies turned up. Yeah,
I was going to say it was the year that they were all enthusiastic about Spock.
Star Trek, yes, they were.
Oh, yeah, because it was only just out. The original series was only just out around that time. Okay. So we had Bankson, and so Foister was around at that point.
Foister was around.
Merv Binns, Paul Stevens.
Paul Stevens was around.
Right. Were you at that one, Dave?
I was. That was my first, I think that was my first convention.
I don't remember, but that was my first Australian convention too. Yes.
But there was a lot of, they showed a lot of films because it was in the cinema.
Oh, right, yes.
It was quite a good film program. And that was good.
Well, that was at a time, of course, back in the late 60s, where the only way you could see a decent film was on a big screen. Mm. And so you had to basically rent them, the films, and project them onto the screen so people could see them. Mm. Otherwise, you were just only going to be getting them from television. Mm. And we were black and white at that point, of course. Mm. So you had problems there. So that was the first major convention you'd been to in Australia.
Australian convention.
So you were living in Sydney and you came to Melbourne to the convention.
Yeah.
Now, did anything start at that convention, 1969, regarding a Worldcon bid? Were people muttering about it, or...?
I think there were a few very minor mutters. There were considerably more at the next one, which was in Sydney.
1970 in Sydney?
It was January 1970, and I was on the committee. The other day I found a picture of the six of us that were on the committee. Now, let's see if I can remember. John Brosnan was one.
Oh, okay, yep.
The thing about Synchron 70 was that it was big on comics. John Ryan, who was one of the committee members, knew all the comic artists.
Yep.
He got as many of them as he possibly could to come, and there were several. Mm. I'm not good at the names, but it was a major thing of the convention. And the convention was in the Epping Scout Hall in Sydney. Who else was on the committee?
Was Gary Mason there at that
Gary
time?
Gary Mason was on.
So John Ryan.
John Ryan, me.
Brosnan.
John Brosnan.
Is it Peter Darling? Would he be?
Peter Darling.
Because he was
Peter
in,
Darling. He was parents, basically, ran the food and that sort of thing.
Because Darling was living in Sydney at that time, wasn't he? He ended up coming down to living in Melbourne and working for Telstra for a long time. That's right. So you think that some of the muttering started in 1970?
Oh, a lot happened then. One of the results of the 1970 January convention, because there was another one coming up at Easter, was that we started a sort of fanzine on this topic, and people were contributing, and it was big. Of course, Andy Porter in America had been pushing this for some time, and he reminds me now and again that
it was all his fault.
It's all his fault.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not sure I take it.
No, that's fair enough. A lot of people like to claim responsibility after the fact. Yes. Although I know that Andy Porter's name was around at that point, and he was actually doing a fair bit of work over there. So 1970, there's a fair bit of work going on in Sydney. People are starting to get a bit of an idea that maybe there's a possibility of having something in Australia at some point. Any thoughts about where or when it was going to be at that point, do you think?
Well, I think we were already talking about 1975. I think of the people that were there in 1970, I was probably the only one who'd been to a World Cup.
Oh, okay.
Because I'd been to the New York one in 67. And one of the results of all this discussion was that several of us decided to go to the 1971 in Germany.
Oh, right, yep.
Including Brosnan.
So was that when Brosnan actually went from Australia to Germany overland and ended up in London?
He got involved with this bus group.
Yeah.
They bought an old bus and they went from, I'm not sure where they picked it up, but it certainly did quite a lot of travelling.
So he and you were there in
Germany? We were both there in
Heidelberg.
Heidelberg.
Yep.
And there was another fan who's I'd known for some time, a German, he now lives in Perth.
Oh, okay. Gary Hoff.
Gary Hoff. And when I flew over, he met me at the Frankfurt airport and drove me to Heidelberg, and I forget the distance, but it's not trivial.
Mm.
I still see him from time to time. He's the last time I saw him was at a convention in Perth, but his big interest these days is swimming and athletics.
Sport. Okay.
And he's an international judge on those things.
Oh, okay. So you're there in Heidelberg. Well, I think, am I right in remembering that a certain Gregory Benford was involved in that convention as well?
Oh, yes. Quite a few. Silverberg was there.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of the Germans. There were several Germans that are basically still involved, I think.
Okay.
There were a lot of Brits there. There were a lot of Americans there. But I went back to Heidelberg a year or two ago, and it's changed.
Mm.
We had some sort of function in the Heidelberg Castle or whatever. I think it was just a banquet. I can't think of it. The convention itself wasn't held there. The convention was held in the city hall in Heidelberg, which is quite well set up for that sort of thing. And the hotels, just a lot of small hotels around the town. So it was a very movable, peripatetic sort of convention we hopped around.
So that was the first major push, do you think, from Australians?
I think so, yes. I found somewhere recently a fanzine we'd put out about this for basically as a promotion. And I think Foister was very, very strong on this. And it was translated into German. And we put quite a lot of effort into that. I think we were trying to say, because we were an English-speaking country,
yes,
it didn't mean we were, you know, particularly promoting being English-speaking. We wanted it to be other languages as well. And obviously German was the relevant one at the time.
So the German convention kicks off. There are a lot of Americans there, and they start to pick up on this idea of Australia in 75?
Hopefully some of them did. I'm trying to think who would have been... I doubt if Andy Porter actually went to that convention. I'd have to ask him. I'm still in fairly frequent contact with Andy. But there's a lot of... I think because I got involved with a lot of Americans on the West Coast after that. Andy's on the East Coast.
Yep.
I probably had less to do with him in the year or two afterwards. Because by 1970, it became obvious to us that we had to really push in 1972 at the latest.
Yep.
To get a bid going.
When was the bid decided? Was that 70?
I'd have to look into that.
I think it was 73.
The decision was 1973, which was Toronto.
Because
it was 72 was where we made our big push.
So 70 at that stage, it was 2 years later.
There'd been stuff
went to three for 90. In 99, we had a 3 year period between when the vote was cast, the site selection vote, and the convention, and then it went back to 2 years afterwards.
That's right.
So I think sometime in the 90s there was this period where they went to a 3 year gap, and they decided after a while
that was probably too long. Complicated.
It was too long, and so they went back to 2 years. 2 years seems about right. And so if it was 73 that was up in Toronto. So there was a lot of push going on. Were you getting much from the UK?
Let me think. I'm trying to remember which the UK convention about the time was. I don't think they...
Do they have an EasterCon at that point? Were they running EasterCons?
They were running EasterCons. I don't remember whether we had a big effort to promote it at them.
Possibly because the Australian convention was probably around Easter those times, and so you were putting a lot of your effort in there trying to get the local enthusiasm going.
I'm not quite sure exactly when I became... we had... I can remember committee meetings in Foyster's House quite a lot in Melbourne and before I became chairman.
So this is the problem, Robin. You're in the wrong state. So knowing that you're on the committee and you couldn't argue the toss, well, they just said, "Oh, he'll do." Picked a card out of the pack.
I'd have to. I'm not one of those people that keeps diaries and remembers exact dates.
No, that's okay.
But I'm remembering state. I sort of moved from Sydney to Melbourne. I think it might have been late 70, early 71.
Oh, right. Well, then, yeah.
So I was around when the, you know, there's a lot of brouhaha going on in 71. And I went to the 72 Worldcon in LA. And I think by that time I was chairman.
All right.
And the big thing from our promotion, of course, was John Litch's involvement with the movie.
Mm.
And that was absolutely huge, whether people realized it or not at the time. But the initial version of the movie was silent.
We're talking the anti-fan film?
We're talking the anti-fan film.
Yeah.
And it was made silent. And the soundtrack... became because the Sydney guy with all the money suddenly produced the money.
Yep.
And in a
Ron Graham
suddenly produced the money, and basically Lee Harding organized the sound version, which, while not perfect, was a hell of a lot a big improvement on the film. And what was the whole business about the film getting to LA was quite complicated. So we're talking about, I don't know, August, July, August 1972. And I know I took it in my baggage. But there was another copy. And it got held up in customs.
Oh, okay.
And so my copy became the one that actually got shown. And I don't think they were identical. I think one had a much better soundtrack than the other. Mine was the less good one. When we realized we weren't going to get the good copy out of whatever the customs holdup was in time, we had to go with my copy. And as I recollect, the arrangement I'd got with the LACON people was that we could slip it in into the film program. They had a film program which went on even hours, and every even hour they would have a movie, some sort of movie, and the amount of time available for anything else depended how long there was between that and the next even hour.
Oh, okay. So it was an hour and a half for the main feature.
Yeah,
30 minutes to slip something in. Yeah,
and sometimes the main feature went more than an hour and a half and there wouldn't have been time.
Right.
Anyway, eventually we found a slot and we slipped it in. And, you know, the main feature, I don't even remember what feature it was, had finished and people were sort of picking up and moving on because they had other things to go to. And you've got, I don't know if you remember how the movie started, but it's Mervyn Binns being driven up in a car which they describe as a limousine, and someone is brushing the dust out of the way so that he doesn't have to soil his feet with the dust in the street. And a few people started to realise this is a little bit funny, you know. Why are they showing this? It sounds a bit like some dreadful travelogue. You know, it's a black and white movie and the sound is a little bit shaky. And a few people realised that maybe this was funny and stopped moving off to wherever else they were going. It was hilarious because eventually, you know, most people realised that it really was quite funny.
So that was the first showing?
That was the first showing. And it was sometime fairly early on in LACON. And of course, not everyone is watching the video and the movie program anyway, but it was word of mouth. And after that, I should add that the people who were there were basically me and Bill Wright. And we got a room by the pool. The particular hotel this con was at was out by the airport, and they had a pool. And of course, it was open air, and there bloody planes going over every couple of minutes. So the sound was fairly distracting, you'd say. But the net result of the popularity this achieved was that we were running the film the bloody continuously. Neither Bill nor I could really take more than 10 minutes away.
So a groundswell started to build up.
Well, the groundswell started to build up then. And by the time in 1972, they were voting on the 74 convention.
Yep.
Which I'm not sure I remember who the competing bids were, but I know one was DC and DC won. And by that time, it was obvious that we had a serious bid for the following year. No, it was a very funny period.
So post-LA, did you leave? I sort of get the impression that the Indyfam film had stayed in America.
It stayed in America and started
to get carted
the
around.
The person that did all the carting around was Jack Chalker.
Oh, okay.
I've got a book of his here I'm reading at the moment, which is fun. But Jack had been a sort of fannish entrepreneur for some time. He'd been running these indexes of things and he'd been publishing stuff about science fiction. He wasn't that well known as a science fiction writer himself at the time, but it was coming along, I suppose. But during the year between 72 and 73 conventions, he did tell me how many cons he'd showed it at. I think it was over 70.
Ooh.
I mean, it was basically more than one a week. Unbelievable.
Yeah, there was just massive numbers of them. If you look back at the con listings at that time, well, we used to get amazed. You'd look at it and you'd be one or two in Australia in a year. Yeah. And there they had one or two. They were doubling up, well, one side of the country and the other side on the same bloody weekend.
I don't know that he was able to get to both of those, but...
he got to a lot.
By this time, of course, there were two copies of the film.
Oh, well, so maybe somebody else was putting
it
around.
It was shown an incredible number of times. I mean, at LACon, I'm sure I showed it 20 times, probably more.
So it was really, really popular. We
weren't allowed to stop showing it, basically.
So that built up a lot of enthusiasm, in the US.
I'd have to say there were other things. I mean, I've still got boxes of matches. We made matchboxes.
Yeah.
Matchbooks,
yep.
Except they weren't books. Matchbooks, the Americans are used to. Matchboxes, they're not. And we had matchboxes, and they became popular. Gerald, somebody, anyway, he did a cartoon of a sort of mouse, kangaroo type character.
Yep. And that became the mascot?
And that became a sort of mascot. And they. I seem to remember we made 10,000 books of matches, and I've still got about 500. But there's a hell of a lot got distributed.
So you're moving through 72. There's a lot of people in the US who are enthusiastic.
Yeah.
It's all moving ahead very nicely.
Chalker more than anybody. Chalker's the unbelievable.
And it moves through towards 1973. Where the site selection ballot is going to be held for 1975.
Was held in Toronto, and Bruce Gillespie was there.
Yep.
And sort of fronted the bid. By this time, of course, we had to announce guests of honour and so forth. And I have to say that I was on the wrong side on the guest of honour. I wanted James Blish.
Okay.
You know, we're so lucky that it wasn't, because he died 6 weeks before the convention.
Yep.
Would have been a
disaster. Yep. So you get through to 1973, you win the bid.
We win the bid and
you win the right to hold the convention in 1975.
Right.
And then the realisation hits that you've got to do all this bloody work.
Well, yeah. I can remember being rung up by Bruce... saying, we won. And
Who were we up against? Who was the company?
Oh, let me see. I think they sort of fell by the wayside. I seem to remember there was a San Francisco bid, but I could be getting muddled up on that one. Mm. Jumping ahead a bit, the following year at DISCON, Le Guin could not be there. And she won a Hugo for one of the shorter stories, I think. And someone decided it would be a good idea for me to ring her to tell her. And so I'm sitting in some committee member's room, running up their phone bill, ringing up Ursula across the country. And she said, "Oh, Robin, I didn't realize you would be at the convention. I wrote a letter to you a week ago saying I couldn't make the convention."
Couldn't come to...
attend the following year.
75, yeah.
And so there's me on the phone with the sort of things falling in on top of me.
Why did she say she couldn't go?
Well, the reason was her husband, who is an academic... had a year's sabbatical coming up and wanted to go to France. You know, she had decided that, you know, it was all a bit difficult. She would go with her husband.
Yep.
They had children as well, and they were going to take a year off in France.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought rather hard and rather quickly. And... said, have you written to Bruce as well? And she said, yes. But this was only a week before, and the chances were Bruce hadn't got the letter yet.
Yep.
I certainly hadn't, because I was in the wrong place. And I said, you know, we may be able to do something about this. How would it be if we were to produce some funding for you to run a workshop?
A writer's
now,
workshop.
Now, the way I'm talking about it now, it sounds as if I had this idea, and I didn't. It was Bruce who had the idea already, as I recall. And he was hoping he could get the Australia Council, which was very new at the time.
Yes.
I'm not even sure it had been officially set up. But I said, let me... Don't commit yourself if you possibly can avoid it totally. Let's see if we can arrange for you to fly via Australia to France.
Okay.
And yeah. We'll see if we can make a substantial effort.
Because she was on the West Coast. She'd come across
the Pacific. She was on the West Coast. Going via Australia is the long way round. But
you yeah. still could do it.
Anyway,
it all happened.
Bruce swung the deal. I forget the financial arrangements, but they were not insubstantial. And he organized for, and as it turns out, her husband and at least two of her children to travel with her the long way round. And they all came through Melbourne, and she must have been in Melbourne for at least 2 or 3 weeks because of the workshop mm-hmm. that was part of the deal. And, of course, it was all a brilliant success because, amongst other things, she won the Hugo.
That year, yeah.
Until very recently, I was in considerable trouble, so I would not say who, about that, because this person was convinced he was going to win the Hugo. And I ran into him 6 months before, so sometime between, no, more than 6 months before, on the way home from Discon, I ran into this person, and he said, Robin, I'm up for the Hugo next year. Is there any way you can let me know ahead of time if I've won?
Oh, isn't this amazing?
I said, no, that's not possible. You know, the way it works, it's voted by the subcommittee, and the decision would be made only a few days, at most a week before the convention. There's no time. Either you can be told in time or find out ahead of that.
We really need to have a big chat to a lot of people about the Hugos and conversations like that, because in 1999 I had one almost exactly the same, but not with an author, but with a publisher.
The person concerned is dead now. I don't see why I shouldn't tell you his name. It's Jerry Pournelle.
Oh, okay.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, he and Larry Niven had a novel, mm-hmm. and also I think between them a couple of other things in the Hugo list for that year. And Pournelle is a difficult character anyway. But being leant over by this very large person and in a very loud voice in a crowded room with at least 10 other people I knew and dozens more he knew.
Put you in the spot.
Getting this, yeah. You know, is not fun.
No, would not have been.
And he's convinced that I could have done it and just didn't doubt
yeah.
it. Bloody
goodness. Yeah, I know. there's lots of funny... I think
this was months before.
Yeah.
There's a slight follow-up about this. He said, I tell you what, I will get the publisher to post you a copy of the book. And I said, no, this is not a good idea. A, I'm not involved with the committee that
yep.
looks after it. He said, well, we'll do it anyway. In fact, I'll send one to all of the committee. And months later, I don't know, about February or March of 75, I got a phone call from our agent in LA, who was Fred Patton, saying, look, Jerry Pornell's been on the phone to me saying that his publisher has had returned a consignment of 10 hardcover copies of, I've forgotten the name of the damn book now. But what had happened was it had arrived at the correct post office mailbox at a time when the regular person who knew, you know, what was coming in was on holidays, and it wasn't actually addressed to either the Worldcon Committee or Aussiecon or me personally or any of the names that they associated with the thing. It was probably addressed to the Hugo Committee or something like that.
Which the post office didn't recognize.
Which the post office rejected. Now, something comes in airmail, it doesn't go back airmail, no. It goes back surface mail.
Yep.
So months later, they get this back in the States, and Pornell, of course, is convinced that it's all a conspiracy. So he went up to a higher level. And I said to Fred, oh, God, please try and, you know, stop him from exploding. But it's stop them, because it's Niven as well,
yeah,
by this
point. Yeah.
It was not intentional. I can only assume it's because of the actual way it was addressed. It's terribly unfortunate and all that. But it wouldn't have affected us anyway, because, you know, if 10 copies of the book had arrived in time, there's no way I could farm it out to you and the other committee members.
The Hugo is a popular award anyway, so it was the voting.
At some point, I must have tried to explain to them.
10 copies is not going to swipe.
You said, we all know that's just bullshit.
No, I counted the votes.
Sorry, Jerry. No, we don't.
No, we don't.
You know, I met him not long before he died, and it all came up again.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we still never forgot.
I'm the hated character who stopped him getting a Hugo.
Dear, oh, dear. But if
it's
you think about it...
It's Note in God's Eye.
Oh, that's right.
It was a bad book.
But if you think about it, I mean, The Dispossessed winning the Hugo that year, I mean, it's a cracker of a book. Mm. And it's real. It's a classic. And it will go into the... If there ever is going to be such a thing as a science fiction canon, it's in there, wholly and solely, without a shadow of a doubt. So we've gone through with one... We're moving on. Well, there's been all the showings of the anti-fan film all the way around the US. And it finally comes down time for the convention in the Southern Cross Hotel, the late lamented Southern Cross Hotel, now no longer there, in Melbourne. So tell us what it's like when you get there and you suddenly realise there you all are. It's starting.
Well, it started building up a few days before when there was quite a large party of Americans, about 50 of them, I think, arrived in Sydney 4 or 5 days before.
All on the same flight?
On the same flight. It was a charter deal.
Yeah.
We'd set up a travel agent in LA to do this. And the gimmick from our point of view was that for every 15 paying passengers, we got a free ticket.
Ooh, okay.
And so we used the two free tickets, the first two, for the guests of honour. I think they were half fair,
right?
But it was certainly a substantial saving for the fan guests. This is
so you had Susan Wood and Mike Glickson as the fan guests of honour,
who had been married at the time they were selected, but weren't anymore. But luckily enough, we're still good friends.
You had a lot of trouble with guests of honour at this convention, but we'll get on to a little bit more of that a bit later on. So you get all these Americans in at Sydney.
And I went up to meet them, and there was a sort of party at wherever they were staying in Sydney. And some of them were flying down to Sydney from Sydney the following day, and some were coming on the train for whatever.
Another big party.
Yeah. As soon as I got off the plane in Tullamarine, there was a message from Kerry Hanfield saying there's an absolute panic at customs about the art show. Now, one of the things we'd arranged for the convention with the official airline, which was Air New Zealand, because I couldn't get Qantas to cooperate, was that they would carry 10 cartons of artwork to basically sort of get some of the well-known science fiction artists in our art show.
Right.
And the problem was that at the time the customs regulations on art was that any individual item had to be worth more than $100, I think it was. I can't remember if it was US or Australian dollars, in order to get some sort of exemption. And the idiot at the consigners in... what was happening was that all these people sending art to the art show sent it to a consigner in LA who packaged it all up and put it in crates and sent it off on Air New Zealand. And he described them as being worth under $100. And what he was supposed to do was describe them as being worth over $100 each individual item.
Right.
And there were over 100 items.
Okay.
So suddenly there are 100 or whatever items, each of which owing duty before they could be allowed in.
Oh, dear.
And I knew more or less what they were, but I didn't know which crate they were in. And I said to Carey, look, I'm at the airport. I'll go around to the customs and see if I can find someone to talk to. And I found someone to talk to, but he said, how do I know these are valuable, worth more than $100? And I didn't know what was in the crate. What he wanted to do was open one crate at random and for me to identify the artwork. And I wasn't really sure I knew I was going to be able to do that. However, it turned out one of the people in customs was a bit of a science fiction fan.
Ooh,
good.
And I said, well, suppose we get him to look at this stuff and see if he can identify it. And I wish I could remember the name of the bloke, but he came up trumps, because the first crate we opened had four or five bits of cover art from magazines. He said, oh yes, that's a Jack Gorn, and that's a...
Oh, he just picked them off and he knew the artist straight away, Freeze and all. Yeah,
and there were four or five in that first crate that he recognised, and that got us through.
Ooh,
but that was, you can imagine the. I mean, we would have been up for probably $10,000 worth of duty before they could come in and be shown.
Yeah,
and thank God, someone sensible was able to persuade his bosses that. This is the real McCoy.
It's amazing how you get these Worldcons that have these disasters. Yeah, that was the first. That was the first panic.
Disaster of several.
Yeah.
So that was, I think, 2 days before the actual convention started. There was another panic about the. You probably remember we had. I've forgotten the name of the company, but some company that did visual displays for these sort of things, they had got this thing with slide projectors, and it was basically carousels.
I remember those. I remember the carousels.
And so the basic idea was that each session of the convention, not every individual talk or whatever, but morning and afternoon and evening, we would have a 3 or 4 minute slide projection thing, which was related to that particular element. And the photos, we assumed would all be sorted out before, and they weren't. And so we had to go through available slides and select slides for individual items. And I can tell you, this took several hours of work for each presentation. And it was a nightmare. The idea was quite good. The implementation was less than brilliant. Mm. And, of course, it all happened at the last minute.
So the convention starts.
The convention starts.
So we've got Leguina's professional guest of honour.
Yeah.
We've got Susan Wood and Mike Glickson as fan guest of honour. And we've got Don Tuck as Australian guest
of honour.
And Don, I'm sorry
to bring this. Quite late on in the proceedings, it became clear that Don Tuck was not going to appear. Don Tuck lived in Hobart, and I barely knew him. Mike O'Brien was the person who knew him in Hobart. And Mike said, look, we couldn't get Don to actually come over. He was having some sort of family crisis, was the excuse. But I still think it was a bit of an excuse. He was one of those people who found it difficult to meet new people.
All right, bit of a hermit, yeah.
And some of the fans did go over, including Forry Ackman, actually, went over and actually met him, which was a noble effort.
Mm.
But, God.
Yeah, one of the other
things... I kept thinking, if all these crises happen... you know, they can't all get... We can't get over all of them. And we didn't. That was one we didn't.
So the convention's running. There's lots of people milling around the Southern Cross Hotel. How's it all going for the committee and for... Especially for the chair, Robin Johnson?
I seem to remember being in a continuous state of panic that, you know, people weren't going to appear at the right time and that things weren't going to be ready. But in fact, when I compare it with anything more recent, it was very lightly programmed. I mean, we had an art show. Art show was a fairly big thing at this convention, I seem to remember. But we had the movie program was somewhere else. I seem to remember it was one of the now no longer existent movie theatres somewhere in the city. And we had probably no more than two or three streams in the hotel. The main ballroom and a couple of meeting rooms, and that's about it.
Mm.
Nowadays you have 23 streams.
Well, it's unbelievable what they get up to.
Mm.
Some of the big conventions in the US are just astounding in terms of how much programming there is.
One of the big things, of course, was the costume thing. I seem to remember sitting in the, I guess it was part of the service area behind the main hall that people had to go through in costume in order to get in the other entrance. I'm not quite sure why it was necessary for me to be there. I suspect the other committee members had parked me there to stop me getting in the way.
Sometimes it's worthwhile having somebody on the committee that just tells the chair, look, just go there and sit down and just shut up, all right? Don't do it. We've got it all under control. So do you think that it... So how do you think it ran? Do you think I think
it was a huge success.
Yes.
In terms of size, it was bigger than anything we'd had in Australia before, certainly. According to the records, it's about 600. I think there were probably more because we had... I seem to remember that when we set up the art show, we wanted to involve schools around, certainly around Victoria and hopefully the rest of Australia. And that was moderately successful. John Breeden did a lot of the work on this. A month or so before the convention, we took over the lower town hall exhibition space, and we had a big show with loads of mostly not particularly marvellous stuff coming in from the schools, from which we selected some items to go into the main show. In terms of the main show, there wasn't all that much space. And I'm very proud of the fact that we made this huge effort to get stuff in from the States particularly. Though, in fact, there were a couple of quite prominent artists, not from the States, that were there. One was Jim that was exhibiting there. One was Jim Burns.
Mm.
And I'm having trouble with the other gentleman's name. He was Italian, but based in Germany. And he did a lot of covers for basically European science fiction stuff. And he did come to the convention. I think I'm right in saying Jim Burns won the major award that we gave out, sort of committee award we gave out, for three covers for Jack Vance books that were, you could put the things together and they made a larger picture. And the art show was pretty bloody impressive, if I say so myself. And I think it's a bit sad we haven't made that much effort since. But then we were trying to get more Australians interested in worldwide science fiction, as well as getting worldwide people interested in what was going on in Australia. And I must say, for some years, I was under the impression that it hadn't really worked. But now I think it probably did, because there were enough things that people that emerged from the workshops and the things that took years to mature, really, that became obvious later.
So what do you see as the legacy of Aussie
Comics? Oh, I think there's a lot. Look at the number of, not just Australian, but I've just been in New Zealand, there's a huge number of emerging writers now. You know, you could write the number of Australian-based writers in 1975 on the fingers of two hands, probably, but there weren't that many. There's now dozens.
Yeah.
There's dozens in Canberra alone.
Yeah, there's dozens in Melbourne as well, yeah. To me, it sounds like it had a really good reputation. It's considered to be one of the friendly conventions.
Yeah.
Because the Americans were shocked at, from their perspective of how small it was, we were shocked from how big it was. But it seemed to hit a happy medium there, didn't it?
Yeah.
The Americans were able to get around and see everybody. And the other thing was that it had a convention area inside a hotel.
Yeah, it was the first time in Australia, as far as I'm aware, that we'd been able to do that. I mean, I'm thinking back to the 1970 convention that I was on the committee of that was in a scout hole, a suburban scout hole.
This is almost like the space program going from being able to fly a plane landing on the moon in 10 years, and we went from a scout hole to a major city hotel in five.
Don't let's take that parallel too far. It's been 50 years since we had men on the moon.
That's true. Hopefully we're going back shortly. So the convention, 600 people?
600 people. I'm not sure offhand of the numbers of the last three Worldcons, but a lot bigger.
Yeah.
And I think I'm right in saying the London one was the biggest ever at the time it was held. So you don't have to be in America to have huge conventions.
No, you don't. And also, as I was saying, that from an Australian perspective, it was really big.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of things have come from that. I mean, I really don't think that there might have been 1985, there might have been 99 or 2010 without 1975, but it certainly made it a heck of a lot easier to get 85 and the other two because 1975 had happened. And to me, I look at 1975 these days as being the science fiction fanish equivalent of the 1956 Olympics in Melbourne, where that was considered to be the friendly games. I would think that you're still getting people coming up to you from time to time saying how much they enjoyed that convention.
Well, it still happens. One of the reasons I enjoy going to Worldcons now is because of that. As you know, they do, for example, these photos.
Yep.
I don't know if you remember, you were at the one in San Jose.
I was in Helsinki. I wasn't in San Jose. Yeah.
I did something rather naughty in San Jose.
What did you do?
The last couple of Worldcons just started calling themselves Worldcon number whatever.
Yeah.
And I suddenly thought, as the camera goes round, you're supposed to say, AussieCon or AussieCon 2 or whatever it was at the year. So I just said WorldCon 75, which was the wrong name because, of course, we were 1975, not 75. I think 75 was last year, or was it
Helsinki? That was the Helsinki one, yes. I remember that. I was standing two rows behind you when you said that. So you still keep going to Worldcons?
Well,
still...
so far, and I've certainly every intention of going next year to Wellington, because I think they're going to put on a pretty good show, actually.
Okay.
They're doing very good publicity, I think. They had a killer of a slogan early on, 2020 vision.
Yeah. Anything else you'd like to add regarding the convention that you hold fondly, or?
Well, it's funny, when I go to a Worldcon nowadays, it's quite rare to go into a session because I'm mostly it's social.
Yes.
I'm seeing people I know and people have been friends for umpteen years. I have friends like Gary Hoff, who I've known since before I came to Australia. So since the early 60s. I only ever see him at conventions.
Yep, it happens.
Oh, it might be worth just thinking about this. Because I went to the 72 convention on the West Coast, I've been, because we set up Fred Patton, who lived there, as the main AussieCon agent. Though in terms of publicity, the Jack Chalker was the big guy. I've always felt fairly closely associated with LA fandom. And it's interesting that because of the success of the first LA Con in 72, they, or the local fanish group, made a lot of money and were able to buy a clubhouse. They are now in the situation where they don't have a clubhouse. They are meeting in a church hall, rather like the Melbourne Science Fiction Group. The difference is they've got $750,000 in the bank from selling the old one. And the only reason they don't have a clubhouse is because they got gazumped just before they went firm on it. And they're still looking for a clubhouse in a place that isn't surrounded by... I think the main reason they sold the last one was the area had become a sort of druggy area and become a bit dangerous. I think the club, the only other clubhouse I know of that's still going is in Boston. And that's partly because NESFA, the local group, is heavily into publishing and they've got quite a large financial operation mm-hmm. going. And they need a base to do that from. So they bought a suburban house with a backyard and quite a lot of space. And they're able to do their publishing from there. And they store massive quantities of unsold books there. But at every convention I go to in America, and I don't only go to Worldcons, I see NESFA actively promoting their books, and they're able to do it. I think it's something I would have liked to have seen Melbourne done as hasn't been able to do. I would like to see the Melbourne Science Fiction Club having a clubhouse or at least a regular meeting place where they can store stuff. Part of their problem at the moment is they have a large library which they're having to pay to store.
Yes.
And you know, if you've got your own building, this becomes a solution to the problem. I don't know that AussieCon I'm trying to remember where one would look up the financial results, but they weren't particularly... it wasn't a profitable thing. I mean, it wasn't intended to be. But the one or two conventions that have been, the Northeast Cons and the LA Cons, have made substantial amounts of money and have been able to invest it in a clubhouse, and that's helped the thing going. Having said that, I think under current conditions, fandom is largely electronic.
Yes.
And so maybe you don't need a clubhouse.
Thank you very much, Robin, for your time. It was very much appreciated. It's been an excellent conversation. We'd probably like to have a chat to you again at some time in the future on topics other than AussieCon. Yeah.
Well, that's it for this episode. Thanks for listening, and please join us in another fortnight's time. See you. Bye.